From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
And so my truth is that I am a gay American, and I am blessed to live in the greatest nation, with a tradition of civil liberties, the greatest tradition of civil liberties in the world, and a country which provides so much to its people.
In a surprise announcement, James McGreevy, the governor of New Jersey, announces he's resigning because he's gay and had an affair. What did a sexual harassment suit have to do with his announcement? Then the Washington Post admits that it pushed aside dissent in the march to war. And Yasser Hamdi may soon be free.
This case was always about the scope of presidential power and not really about the actions of Yasser Hamdi.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Conflicting reports are coming out of Iraq that Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr has been injured during a U.S. attack on the holy city of Najaf. One spokesperson for the cleric said, quote, "The injuries are in his chest, legs, and arms. He was hurt in an attack while checking one of the fighting battalions." But another said, quote, "Muqtada was not hurt, and there is a lull in fighting from last night." Sadr printed up a statement that was handed out to his followers in Najaf. It read, quote, "If I die a martyr or if I am taken prisoner, I urge the Al-Mahdi army to continue to fight the occupation forces." The U.S. assaulted the city with fighter jet planes and tanks. Smoke engulfed the center of the city. And fighting continued in the Holy Cemetery outside the city, where over 2 million Shiite Muslims from around the world are buried. Yesterday, U.S. forces raided Sadr's house in Najaf, but he wasn't home. The U.S. urged residents of Najaf to leave the city. One announcement from the U.S. to the residents read, quote, "Leave the city. Help coalition forces. Do not fire at them. We are here to liberate the city." Meanwhile, in Baghdad, followers of Sadr were urged to travel to Najaf today after Friday prayers to help fight the U.S. forces. Protests are continuing around the Shiite world against the attacks on Najaf, one of the holiest cities in the Muslim world. Yesterday, Najaf's deputy governor and half of the 30-member provincial council resigned to protest the U.S. assault. The deputy governor said, quote, "I resign from my post denouncing all the U.S. terrorist operations that they are doing against this holy city." In Iran, thousands marched through the streets of Tehran to protest the U.S. actions in Najaf. In Basra, members of the Iraqi resistance have kidnapped a British reporter from the Sunday Telegraph. A videotape has been released showing a hooded militant standing next to the journalist, James Brandon. The militant is heard saying, quote, "We demand the American forces withdraw from Najaf within 24 hours or we will kill this British hostage." Negotiations have begun between Iraq's interim government and al-Sadr over ways to end the standoff. High-ranking governmental officials have called on Sadr to leave the holy shrine. And the International Committee of the Red Cross says it has deep concerns about a spike in deadly clashes in flashpoint cities across Iraq, including Najaf, Kut, and Sadr City in Baghdad. In New Jersey, Governor James McGreevy held a stunning news conference where he announced he was resigning from the office because he had an affair with another man. The governor said, quote, "I am a gay American." He said, quote, "Shamefully, I engaged in adult consensual affair with another man, which violates my bonds of matrimony. It was wrong. It was foolish. It was inexcusable." McGreevy became perhaps the country's highest ranking politician to ever come out while serving in office. He announced his resignation ahead of a sexual harassment lawsuit, which is expected to be filed shortly by his former aide. We'll have more on this in a few minutes. Meanwhile, in California, the state Supreme Court voided the marriages of some 4,000 same-sex couples who married in San Francisco earlier this year. The court ruled that San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom had overstepped his authority by issuing the marriage licenses to same-sex couples. This update on the investigation as to who within the White House outed Valerie Plame as a CIA agent. The New York Times reporter Judith Miller has become the latest reporter subpoenaed in the grand jury investigating the leak. A senior Israeli military official has told the Israeli newspaper Yediot Aharonot that Israel could withdraw from the Golan Heights as part of an eventual peace deal with Syria. In Nablus, three BBC journalists were held at gunpoint for 4 hours by Israeli forces after the army interrupted their interview with a Palestinian doctor and one of his 85-year-old patients. Troops confiscated their tapes and phones. The Israeli army claimed the journalists had walked into an undercover operation. And civil rights leader Jesse Jackson and Congressmember Dennis Kucinich have signed an open letter of support to Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, who faces a recall vote on Sunday. The letter reads in part, quote, "We are disturbed by our own government's interference in your internal affairs. The National Endowment for Democracy, a group funded by the U.S. Congress, has financed radical opposition leaders in their efforts to cut short your term. Some of the individuals funded by the NED participated in the April 2002 coup attempt against you." Other signers of the letter include historian Howard Zinn, journalist Naomi Klein, and Blaise Bompain. And over a million people in Cuba and Florida have been forced to evacuate their homes to escape the approaching Hurricane Charley. Charley's expected 120-mile-per-hour winds and massive storm surge could devastate low-lying areas of Tampa and St. Petersburg. We'll have more on that story in a few minutes. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners, viewers, and those listening in on the internet at democracynow.org.
Well, a surprise announcement yesterday. New Jersey Governor James McGreevy announced he is resigning because he is gay and having an affair, he said.
At my most reflective, maybe even spiritual level, there were points in my life when I began to question what an acceptable reality really meant for me. Were there realities from which I was running? Which master was I trying to serve? I do not believe that God tortures any person simply for its own sake. I believe that God enables all things to work for the greater good. In this, the 47th year of my life, it is arguably too late to have this discussion, but it is here and it is now. At a point in every person's life, one has to look deeply into the mirror of one's soul and decide one's unique truth in the world, not as we may want to see it or hope to see it, but as it is. And so my truth is that I am a gay American, and I am blessed to live in the greatest nation with a tradition of civil liberties, the greatest tradition of civil liberties in the world, and a country which provides so much to its people. Yet, because of the pain and suffering and anguish that I have caused to my beloved family, my parents, my wife, my friends, I would almost rather have this moment pass. For this is an intensely personal decision, and not one typically for the public domain.
That was Governor James McGreevy of New Jersey. With that announcement, he became perhaps the country's highest-ranking politician to ever come out while serving in office. But that isn't the whole story. McGreevy is expected to be slapped with a sexual harassment suit by a former top aide, Golan Sepel, who he had met in Israel 4 years ago. After their meeting, Sepel moved to New Jersey and worked on McGreevy's campaign for governor. McGreevy helped him find a car, a job, and an apartment a tenth of a mile from the Woodbridge townhouse he shared with his wife.
According to the Newark Star-Ledger, the Israeli National would go on to play a controversial role in McGreevy's political life over the next 2 years, first as the newly elected governor's homeland security advisor and then as a special counsel with ill-defined responsibilities and a $110,000 salary. A federal law enforcement official said McGreevy's office had called the FBI yesterday and complained that Sepel had requested $5 million to quash the suit, which assistants to the governor saw as extortion.
We go first to Laura Popel, who is with the New Jersey Gay Lesbian Coalition. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's great to have you with us. Well, we have this announcement, which on the face of it, on the face of the press conference that Governor McGreevy held yesterday, was a high-level government official announcing he was resigning because he was gay and had had an affair, though it looks like there is a lot more to this. Your response?
Well, what I heard in the press conference yesterday was a high-level elected official making a very personal decision, as he said, making a very personal decision in a very public way. So many gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered people struggle with the coming out process. It can be a long process. It is a deeply personal process. It's a challenging process, and by virtue of being a public official, he did it in what had to be under a great deal of public scrutiny, public pressure, certainly with a spotlight on him in a way that most people don't. And so that was a lot of what I heard in the press conference. I also heard him talking about how it has affected his family, his friends, the process, his being a gay American, and that is what I heard him referring to when he was saying that he was resigning from office. I make that distinction from what you said because I firmly believe and I hope that the governor would agree that coming out as a gay American does not preclude someone being able to lead a state or a nation in anything. It doesn't preclude leadership in any way.
Well, no doubt it was a painful decision for him, and he had to go through enormous emotional emotions in his own sense to get to that spot. But the reality is at the same time that obviously the reason why he resigned was because he was in effect, he would have to have dealt with the reality that he had given a very high level job to a person who was basically in a personal relationship with him. And that was really apparently what triggered the threat of the suit, the allegations that there was an extortion, that this was what actually triggered the resignation more than the fact that he was coming out as gay. Would you agree with that or not?
I'm not in the governor's head. I really can't say. I just know that we now do have a highly ranking official who is an openly gay person.
We're talking to Laura Popel, who is with the New Jersey Gay Lesbian Coalition. There was also news across the country yesterday, the announcement out of California that the 4,000 marriages that had been performed in San Francisco had been nullified. This is San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom, who spoke responding to the decision of the court. It was the state Supreme Court that voided the marriages of some 4,000 same-sex couples. The court ruled that the San Francisco mayor, Gavin Newsom, had overstepped his authority by issuing the marriage licenses to the same-sex couples. This is Mayor Newsom's response.
Society needs to wake up and say enough's enough. Discrimination, separate, does not mean equal. Discrimination exists in this country and exists against gays and lesbians and bisexuals, and it is wrong, and they took a stand. And I'm proud of those 40,000 couples. I am proud of the people that had the courage to make their way to San Francisco, those San Franciscans that had the courage to stand up on principle and say, I do. And there is nothing any judge, lawyer, politician will ever do to take away the moment those couples shared.
That was San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom. We are joined on the telephone by Kate Kendall, who's executive director of the San Francisco National Center for Lesbian Rights. Your response to the ruling?
Well, I think it's fair to say that the ruling was not particularly surprising. The court really signaled that they were quite displeased with what the mayor had done. And even though as a legal matter, I disagree with the conclusion that he'd overstepped his authority, I think there's good legal precedent to support it. The bigger issue and the more human issue and the one that I'm still feeling pained by is the nullification of the 4,037 marriage licenses, because these are not just pieces of paper. They represent a couple, they represent a family, they represent the couples choosing to publicly commit to each other, and they represent the first time the government gave legitimacy and respect to those relationships. And that respect and legitimacy and the promise of that has been withdrawn. And I think it's a sad time for these couples, and I feel for them.
Now, there is another case, though, making its way up to the court, isn't there, in challenging the actual legality of California's ban on same-sex marriages?
That's correct, and that's really the most important issue to understand here. The court made very clear, repeatedly actually, which was quite heartening, that they were not ruling at all on the merits of whether or not it was constitutional to not permit lesbian and gay couples to marry in California. We were invited, essentially, to file a lawsuit on March 11th, when the court ordered the city of San Francisco to stop issuing marriage licenses. They said, but, you know, if somebody wants to file a lawsuit challenging this marriage discrimination in California under the California Constitution, we certainly invite that to happen. And the very next morning, the National Center for Lesbian Rights, along with the ACLU and Lambda Legal, on behalf of a dozen couples, filed that lawsuit. And it is that lawsuit that the court spoke of. They're aware of it. And just like Massachusetts, Washington State, Oregon, where there's a lawsuit, New Jersey, where there's a lawsuit, this issue will ultimately be decided as a constitutional matter, actually by this very court that decided and issued this ruling yesterday. And that'll probably happen within the next year to 18 months.
Your response to these two announcements yesterday, the court decision overturning the same-sex couples unions and New Jersey Governor McGreevy announcing he's a gay American and saying he will be resigning?
Yeah, I have to say, you know, we were right in the heat of all the response to the Supreme Court ruling, and then, you know, immediately coming across our email is what McGreevy's is the content of McGreevy's statement. You know, I suppose I was a little bit troubled by McGreevy's statement, because while I understand he now is embracing his identity as a gay man, and I appreciate that, and I definitely agree with my colleague that this is the coming out process is a painful and deeply personal one for some folks, painful for some. You know, the fact is he's been able to ride a lot of privilege, undeserved privilege, as being seen and experienced by the voters as a straight man. And I do think there needs to be a little bit of a reflection on his part that he's had a lot of heterosexual privilege because he hasn't been out or honest or open about who he truly was. And so I do think there's more to the story. There's more to be told. I certainly don't think he's disqualified from office. I don't even think he's resigning because he's actually gay. I think the issue is really more what was said on the program. There are other scandals surrounding some of what's gone on. I think the extramarital affair, regardless of whether it was with a man or a woman, you know, is problematic, obviously, in public office now. But I do think that there's a lot more to his situation that should be reflected upon.
I want to thank you both very much for being with us. We've been joined by Kate Kendall, who is director of the San Francisco National Center for Lesbian Rights, and on the line with us from New Jersey, Laura Popel, New Jersey Lesbian and Gay Coalition. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, the largest public media collaboration in the country, broadcasting on over 240 Pacifica radio stations, NPR stations, public access TV stations on PBS, and on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network, Free Speech TV, Channel 9415, four times a day, and on Link TV. Direct TV, channel 375. And you can also video and audio stream us and see our transcripts online at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. The Washington Post has published a major 3,000-word front page story examining how the paper downplayed critics of the Iraq War before the U.S. attacked last year. Pentagon correspondent Thomas Ricks revealed how in October 2002, editors killed a piece of his entitled Doubts that outlined how many senior Pentagon officials were reluctant about plans to attack Iraq. Ricks also added, quote, "The paper was not front-paging stuff. Administration assertions were on the front page. Things that challenged the administration were on page A18 on Sunday or A24 on Monday. There was an attitude among editors," he said, "look, we're going to war. Why do we even worry about all this contrary stuff?"
Executive editor Leonard Downey Jr. admitted mistakes were made. He said, quote, "Across the country, the voices raising questions about the war were lonely ones. We didn't pay enough attention to the minority." We're now joined by Michael Massing. In February, he wrote a major article in the New York Review of Books titled Now They Tell Us on the press coverage leading up to the Iraq invasion.
And he has an upcoming book by that title. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you with us. Can you respond to this front page story in the Washington Post?
Yes, I was very encouraged by it. It was a good piece. It was prominently displayed. It was particularly significant, I think, both for documenting actually what the Post did and did not do in its coverage, and then also getting these very straightforward quotes from Len Downey, as we just heard, and other editors reflecting on what happened. The editors there had different views on it, but Len Downey, the man in charge, really was just very frank in saying, basically, we blew it. I think Kurtz did a good job in talking to people like Ricks. I didn't know about that Ricks story that got killed, and that was a real stunner. And that he is so obviously these reporters are still rankled by a lot of this, and they're talking on the record about it, and that the Post ran it. It's part of a process that is now occurring where papers like the Post and the Times are trying to come to terms with how much they blew the run-up to the war.
Well, but in essence, aren't they coming to terms with the reality of how badly the war has gone now, so that it's okay now to be able to question your own mistakes? Because, for instance, Downey says in that article that that the voices were lonely ones opposing the war, but there were people like Scott Ritter, a former head of UNSCUM who, or former chief of a player in UNSCUM, who was interviewed on this show, who I wrote about the Daily News, who was talking all around the country, saying that Iraq had no weapons of mass destruction and that he knew because he had been involved in eradicating the original weapons supply. So there was plenty of evidence out there if only they had chosen to listen.
Well, the Scott Ritter case is complicated because he flipped himself. He was a big hawk, and then he changed, and he got involved in making a documentary that the source of funding, who knows what. But beyond that, you're absolutely right. There were a lot of people. There were a lot of military people, such as the ones in the Ricks article, who were dissenting. There were people in the streets by the tens of thousands who were all put, again, on inside pages. And you're absolutely right. It's only because the war has gone badly that now people are looking back. And frankly, I fear that in another period when sort of we have a popular president pushing a policy, that the press will again show the sort of spinelessness that it did in this period.
I'm looking at the piece, which had started on the front page and then goes to almost a front, a full page on the inside. And it quotes Leonard Downey saying, "We're so focused on trying to figure out what the administration was doing. We're not giving the same play to people who said it wouldn't be a good idea to go to war. And we're questioning the administration's rationale. Not enough of those stories were put on the front page. That was a mistake on my part." Across the country, he said, "The voices raising questions about the war were lonely ones. We didn't pay enough attention to the minority." Now, this is what I wanted to ask you about. Are we really talking about the minority? If you look at the polls leading up to the invasion of Iraq, more than half the people in this country were opposed to war for more inspections and more diplomacy. Is he saying we didn't give enough attention to the minority? Is that what it is? Or is it simply we give too much attention to those in power, and those in power actually reflect the minority? We're talking about people in this country being the silenced majority, mm-hmm. silenced by corporate media like the Washington Post, the New York Times, and the networks.
Well, I think you're onto something there. In another quote, I thought one of the most revealing, Karen DeYoung, one of the top editors, said that, let's face it, we're basically a mouthpiece for whatever administration is in power. And I think that she is basically saying that that's the reality, let's face it. But it's an amazing admission of how our major media have, in fact, served as conveyor belts. And this was a classic case of it. I think that one thing missing from this article was a true wrestling with the roots of the failure. And I think the roots do go to the fact that the media have gotten so much toward a position to be handmaidens to the people in power.
Might you say embedded in the power elite in this country?
Yes, certainly. That's it. I mean, dinner parties going on in which high officials go to the houses of journalists. Journalists wanting to get, I mean, for instance, Pentagon correspondents flying with Donald Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz to Iraq and Afghanistan, they want to be on that plane. And they know that if they write things that are too critical, they're not going to get seats there. Also, the fear. Dana Priest, a reporter for the Post, talking about the hate mail they got. I also quoted that in the piece that I wrote for the New York Review. There's an atmosphere of intimidation now. We've got a whole constellation from Fox News to Rush Limbaugh to all these rabid talk show hosts and the administration itself ready to pounce on anyone who sticks their neck, you know, any nail that comes up, they're going to hammer it down. And your career can be shredded if you speak out too much against those in power.
Well, interestingly, the self-criticisms have come so far, at least among daily newspapers, from the New York Times and the Washington Post, both of whom, while they may be influential among opinion makers in the country, really do not reach masses of Americans in across the nation, and both of which, because they are largely, although they're publicly traded corporations, are still largely family controlled, and therefore have a certain amount of independence. But you're not seeing any self-criticism yet from the huge chains, the Gannetts and the Knight Ridders and the Tribune companies, who have many newspapers and who are really
Knight Ridder. We just that is one organization that actually distinguished itself, as I tried to show. They were one of the few places that actually did give voice to more of the dissent about the war. So it's a mixed bag, but you're right. I mean, the Times and the Post have been the ones. But let's face it, they do have a big agenda-setting role. All the TV networks read them and so on. So I do feel it's healthy that this is happening. I mean, it's really late. I mean, it's 16 months after the war that they're finally wrestling with this. Why did it take them so long? And will the next time, will it stop them from the next time again that I see even now, like as somebody on the web was writing, the handover of power, the sovereignty in Iraq, there was a huge fall off in coverage. It's sort of like, okay, like we're disengaging the press, let's disengage. Look at Afghanistan. The press is just ignoring that. What is going on there? How often does that story get on the front page? Again, we're seeing the agenda get set by the administration, and even our top news organizations sort of meekly follow along.
Looking at the piece again, the Post on WMD's An Inside Story, they write, from August 2002 through March 19, 2003, launch to war, the Post ran more than 140 front page stories that focused heavily on administration rhetoric against Iraq. Some examples. These are the headlines. Cheney says Iraqi strike is justified. War cabinet argues for Iraq attack. Bush tells United Nations it must stand up to Hussein or U.S. will. Bush cites urgent Iraqi threat. Bush tells troops prepare for war. Reporter Karen DeYoung, a former assistant managing editor who covered the pre-war diplomacy, said contrary information sometimes got lost. She said the caution and the questioning was buried underneath the drumbeat. The hugeness of war preparation story tended to drown out a lot of stuff. And then they look at that key Colin Powell speech, February 5th, 2003. At the UN. And it says the tendencies were on display on February 6th, the day after Powell delivered a multimedia presentation at the UN using satellite images and intercepted phone calls to convince the world that Hussein was hiding weapons of mass destruction. An accompanying front page story by DeYoung and Walter Pincus examined Powell's unprecedented release of U.S. intelligence. Not until the ninth paragraph did they offer a however clause, saying that a number of European officials and U.S. terrorism experts believe that Powell's description of an Iraqi link to al-Qaeda, quote, appeared to have been carefully drawn to imply more than it actually said. I mean, this is an absolutely key point, and this goes beyond the Washington Post. That period, in the week leading up to Powell's address and the week afterwards, that two-week period, FAIR did a study, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, the Media Watch Group, of the four major nightly newscasts, NBC, ABC, CBS, and PBS's NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. Of these four nightly newscasts, there were 393 interviews done around war. Only three were with anti-war representatives. Out of almost 400 in this critical period in the lead up to war, when people are making up their minds, although more than half were at that point opposed. Your response?
Well, I looked at the Colin Powell speech and the reaction to it when I was doing my analysis, and I think that speech and the period surrounding it is going to go down as a textbook case of a failure of proper press scrutiny of administration statements. Those quotes that you have there could be multiplied many times. They are excruciatingly embarrassing now when you look at them. Unfortunately, Kurtz did not look at the Washington Post editorial page, which was probably the leading cheerleader in the print media for the war. They ran four stories. They ran an editorial basically saying the case for war was now irrefutable. And they ran four op-ed page pieces, all of them favorable, gushing. One of them by Mary McGrory, who ran a much looked at column, said, "I'm persuaded." So it's sort of like this, there was like a mass sort of delusion that took root in the media. I mean, it's incredible.
But for those of us who have some historical knowledge of the role of the press in American society, this is not really surprising, whether it's the lead-up to the Mexican War, whether it's the lead-up to the Spanish-American War.
You go back further than 91.
You can, at least to what I've read about it, is that this has been a regular feature of the American press in major conflicts, creating a drumbeat in the population for war, regardless of what the facts are. And I think I've always maintained that the biggest test of a journalist, of any journalist in any country, is what do you do when your country goes to war? Because inevitably, in every war, all governments try to persuade their people that the war is justified. But obviously, in every war, at least one side is wrong, if not both. But the press in any country generally falls in line when the call to war goes out from their government.
Noam Chomsky quotes Walter Lippmann saying, it's the press manufactures consent for war.
Well, I think it's, the war issue is part of this broader phenomenon that I see of the pack mentality. Journalists love to run together in packs. There is a sort of allergy against being too strained too far from the pack. So not only war, but when there's a consensus, when there's conventional wisdom, although, as you pointed out, there was hardly a consensus on the war, but within the establishment, there sort of was. And the media just, they are so spineless. That's the word that comes to mind. As I have said in the past, they like to show courage when they know they're going to be applauded for it. But in times when courage really requires standing up and sort of maybe taking some brickbats, some heat, they hate to do it.
I mean, let's just look at the reality on the ground at that time, because some might say, well, you have hindsight here. No, February 5th is Colin Powell's address. February 15th. The largest mass protest in the history of the world. The numbers vary, 10 million, 20 million, 30 million people around the globe rocked the globe for peace. And yet the response in the U.S. media were some big pictures, but in terms of what's proportionate to this level of mass protest, that's what they were up against, and yet they were still broadcasting the voices of this minority elite.
Well, not only that, while people were in the streets around the world, as you point out, in the UN community, reports were coming out from Mohamed El-Baradei and the International Atomic Energy Agency basically saying, look, our inspectors have gone to over 100 sites. We have not found any evidence of any nuclear program there. These reports were put out. I went back again and looked. They were all these pro forma reports on the inside pages of these newspapers. And meanwhile, when Colin Powell, I did a contrast between Colin Powell's speech and this sort of gushing coverage and the El-Baradei comments, which were basically ignored. And they right there in real time were saying, we cannot find any evidence of this nuclear program that Dick Cheney and all these others and Colin Powell are talking about.
My brother David Goodman and I wrote the book, The Exception to the Rulers, where we're talking about this media criticism. The corporate media will not touch it, though it's become a national bestseller, which is remarkable because they won't touch it because we're taking on them. The subtitle, Exposing Oily Politicians, War Profiteers, and the Media That Love Them. But one of the things we point out is in that press conference where the drumbeat started, that was Bush and Blair in September of 2002. This is after Andrew Card was asked why they weren't pushing harder. Bush was on the Crawford Ranch on an extended vacation. Why weren't they pushing harder to justify the imminent war? And Andrew Card, the former GM lobbyist, now the chief of staff, said, from a marketing point of view, we don't introduce new products in August. So in September, Bush and Blair at Camp David hold that news conference, and they announced that Saddam Hussein was going to get nuclear weapons within six months. And according to a report from the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, all the media covered this press conference. Very few mentioned. The Washington Post buried many paragraphs later that the IAEA had come out with no such report. George Bush had crowed, we don't need much more. He said, how much more evidence do we need? Our response was, well, any evidence would have helped. Here you had the IAEA cited. You'd think the reporters would go to the IAEA, and they said there's no such report.
I actually looked into that when I was doing my research, and that Bush statement was based on a New York Times article several days earlier, which itself the IAEA flipped out over. I talked to the people in Vienna at the IAEA, and they said, my God, the New York Times ran this article that made it sound like we were finding that that Iraq was engaging in all this new suspicious activity. So they run this report on page A7. Bush picks it up, says the IAEA has come out with this, and you're absolutely right. The people at the IAEA were tearing their hair out. They said, no one called us to confirm or find out more about this report Bush referred to. So, yes, they picked it up, they meekly ran with it, and it's a perfect case of how just the most basic repertorial skepticism or even follow-up was missed in this case.
You know, it's fascinating that Leonard Downey, the executive editor of the Washington Post, puts his own quotes to this story about their failure. Because, you know, he recently published a book, The News About the News, American Journalism in Peril, where he criticized the continuing lack of serious attention to news and investigative reporting. And although he said that there were always exceptions, and now we find that shortly after publishing that book, he then is guilty of the very same things that he's criticizing the rest of the media for.
Juan, also, you just came out with this report, How Long Must We Wait, with Joe Torres, looking at the representation of minority reporters in this country. And I can't help but think that militarism and this exclusion in the media of people of color as reporters, that it also weighs in here. Because if you look at the population in this country that was most opposed to war, it was African Americans. Very few represented in the mainstream media in this country.
Overwhelmingly, I think the composition of the National Press Corps covering the Pentagon and covering the White House had been a little different. You might have gotten somewhat different perspective. I know fascinated by a T-shirt that was on sale at the Unity Convention by the Native American journalist, which had a picture of four Native Americans on horseback with rifles, and the T-shirt says "Homeland Security: Fighting Terrorism Since 1492," so that I think that the Native American journalists some of them might have had a different perspective on how we are practicing the war on terrorism in Iraq.
We're talking to Michael Massing, and we almost have to go, but. Talking about looking back, you did this big piece in the New York Review of Books, and you really critiqued the New York Times.
And the Washington Post.
And the Washington Post.
To some degree.
And Judith Miller responded. You talked about Judith Miller's front page drumbeat stories in the Times, that the Times, well, some called it a mea culpa on page A10. We call it a kinda culpa. But what has come of that? And what do you think at this point? What kind of difference do you think this critique has made? Do you think that box made any difference?
Well, the Times in that box said, we realize that we fell down in the run-up to the war, and we are going to show that we are doing better, and the proof will be in what we do. So since then, what has Times done? In fact, on the Abu Ghraib scandal, it was late on that by several days. It just did not pay attention. Then when they realized that they blew it, they threw everything they had into it. And it shows what the Times can do when it does, when it really sets its mind to it. But again, it was almost like the pack was in action. They had, I would say, for 1 month, a story on the front page every day. Meanwhile, everything else gets squeezed out. And with all this events going on in Iraq with the Shiites and the sort of uprising there. I mean, again, the Times is late to that story. The big test for the Times and the Post is going to be, do these mea culpas ultimately lead to a change in the type of reporting? And on that, the jury is still out.
Michael Massing, thank you very much for being with us. I look forward to reading your book, Now They Tell Us. Michael Massing, the author of a big piece in the New York Review of Books on the press coverage in the lead up to the invasion and occupation. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to look at the case of a man who's been imprisoned for 2 years. It looks like he's about to be released. He was never charged. Stay with us.
They say everything can be replaced.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. And Juan, by the way, I'm waiting for one of the big corporate networks or newspapers to do a profile of Pacifica Radio here for 55 years, giving voice to the peace movement in a way that none of these networks has. As they do this self-examination, I think they should stop whiting out the oldest independent media network in this country. Well,
you expecting them to get religion, Amy? I don't hold your breath on that one.
Well, federal prosecutors have indicated that enemy combatant Yasser Sam Hamdi may soon be released. The U.S.-born citizen has been held since he was captured on the battlefields of Afghanistan in late 2001. He's been denied access to a lawyer throughout most of his confinement. Hamdi spent time in Guantanamo Bay's notorious Camp X-Ray before later being moved to a U.S. Navy brig in South Carolina. He's never been charged with a crime and has been largely incommunicado because President Bush deemed him to be an enemy combatant.
In June, the Supreme Court ruled that as a U.S. citizen, Hamdi cannot be held indefinitely without access to the U.S. legal system. This week, Hamdi's attorneys and federal prosecutors made the surprise announcement that they were negotiating terms for his release. Part of the deal may call on Hamdi to renounce his citizenship, move to Saudi Arabia, and accept monitoring by Saudi authorities, as well as promise not to sue the U.S. government.
We're joined by Barbara Olshansky. She is an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, author of Secret Trials and Executions, Military Tribunals, and the Threat to Democracy. Welcome. Hi. Tell us about this case and the significance of this man who's never been charged for 2 years, about to be released.
Well, I think this is an interesting case because it was always really about the president's arrogation of power and the question of whether he had the power to detain people called enemy combatants without any legal rights whatsoever and detain them indefinitely. And it wasn't really so much about Mr. Hamdi, unfortunately. And so what we see now is once the government lost its bid to have that power to detain people indefinitely without rights, it was faced with evaluating the evidence that it had against Mr. Hamdi. And even though it had painted him as a battlefield detainee, his lawyers had always said that he was working in Afghanistan as a humanitarian relief worker. And I think what comes out now is both that the government is admitting that it lost its legal argument and that that Hamdi is not a threat and perhaps was never a threat. And now I think we have to face the question of what have we done to this man by keeping him in prison for 2 years?
But the government, of course, is attempting to paint the brightest picture it can, claiming that they've already gotten all of the intelligence that they needed to get out of him, that this was the reason to hold him originally was to get intelligence out of him, and now they've done that, so they no longer need to hold him.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really the critical point here, because the government really has been saying, both in Hamdi's case, in Padilla's case, and in the case of the people in Guantanamo, that a lot of the reason for the detention, if not solely, and solely for those people that are Americans in prison as enemy combatants, that this was investigatory detention. And what the Supreme Court did say in no uncertain terms is, we don't have that in this country. We never have that. It's never been acceptable. It's not acceptable now. And so by releasing him, it is really, you're right, an admission that they held him for those unlawful, unconstitutional purposes. And that's the reason for this release that they want him to sign. The government is basically admitting by releasing him now that it was holding him for investigation only and that it didn't plan to charge him. And they said the same thing with Padilla.
And the reason for trying to exact a promise from him not to sue, it seems to me, would be to prevent another trial situation where they would have to respond and provide information or evidence as to why they originally held him in the first place.
Huh? Yeah, I mean, I think that's what's going on now. I think even under the minimal due process requirement that the court found is necessary here, that he has to go before a neutral decision maker and he has a right to put on evidence, the government felt it couldn't meet any case to basically support its decision to detain him. And so the thought of having to defend against a lawsuit where they would basically have to admit that they held him for an unlawful purpose, I think, is abhorrent. And they're trying to cut their losses. And I think one of the things that's interesting is that they chose to do this to Mr. Hamdi while they gave John Walker Lind the right to go into criminal trial. And that meant all of those rights that were denied Hamdi were given to John Walker Lind.
What's the difference between them?
Well, I think that's an interesting question. Both were alleged to have held a gun and been in or around the battlefield in Afghanistan. John Walker Lind was raised and grew up in the United States. Yasser Hamdi grew up in Saudi Arabia. I think, you know, John Walker Lind is the son of American parents. Yasser Hamdi is not. I think it's, you know, drawing that conclusion, it really seems to me to have, like, all of the earmarkings of a discriminatory treatment. And I think that is what people have been saying, that a lot of the war on terror is, unfortunately, very closely tied to a war on Arabs and people of the Muslim faith. And I think that is how it's being interpreted around the world.
Of course, John Walker Lind was Muslim. He had converted.
Right.
We're talking to Barbara Olshansky with the Center for Constitutional Rights. When does it look like Hamdi will be released?
Well, according to the DL, they've asked Judge Dumar, Frank Dunham, the public defender, and the government have asked Judge Dumar to put off the next hearing for 21 days so they can hammer this deal out. But my guess is that they'll be able, they're pretty close to a deal, and they'll be able to do this within the next couple of weeks. And then I imagine that he would be released very soon after.
Barbara Olshansky with us, Center for Constitutional Rights. We're going to turn now to another story about civil liberties. And Barbara, maybe you have a comment on this. There's a new report out by the American Civil Liberties Union that has found the government is rapidly increasing its ability to monitor average Americans by tapping into the growing amount of consumer data being collected by the private sector.
The report is titled Surveillance Industrial Complex, How the American Government is conscripting businesses and individuals in the construction of a surveillance society. We're now joined by Barry Steinhardt, director of the ACLU's Technology and Liberty Program.
Welcome to Democracy Now, Barry.
Good morning.
Can you talk about this report on the surveillance industrial complex?
Well, you know, as little as 15 or 20 years ago, we were primarily concerned about the information that the government was collecting itself. It's now increasingly clear that the government has either conscripted companies, for example, banks, which are required to file literally millions of reports about our financial transactions, to many companies that are willingly providing it with data to create what amounts to a surveillance industrial complex. That is to say, the government now is capable of, and in fact does, collect literally millions and millions of pieces of data about us as individuals, and increasingly is experimenting with programs to bring all that data together to create essentially dossiers about individuals.
Can you talk about the most threatening forms of surveillance, what you consider the most serious?
Well, you know, I don't know if there's any single technology or any single database that is the most threatening. It's two things. First of all, it's the trend. And the trend here is towards the collection of all our information and the ability to put all that information together and have it instantly accessible. It's, I suppose, illustrated by a couple of programs. One was the Total Information Awareness Program. That was the Admiral John Poindexter of Iran Contra Infamy, who, on behalf of the research arm of the Pentagon, DARPA, was building this Total Information Awareness Program that had the capability to bring together literally thousands of different pieces of data, whether they came from the government itself or from the private sector, in an attempt to predict who might be dangerous. Or what's known as the Matrix Program, which is sort of the state-level version of Total Information Awareness, which is run out of the state of Florida, but funded by the Department of Homeland Security. In fact, Department of Homeland Security has final say over its operation. And, again, it's an attempt in those states that are participating in many, many states dropped out, including New York State. To put together all this data, both commercial and non-commercial, and to be able to search it about any individual essentially any time that the government chooses to do so, without any judicial oversight, without any cause being required.
Barbara, your response to this, and also there was a report in today's Times about the Census Bureau sharing information by zip code of Arab Americans with the Justice Department, providing all information that they have in their files on where Arab Americans live throughout the country by zip code.
Yeah, you just took the words right out of my mouth. I'm very concerned because of the lack of checks in the commercial arena on the information that's provided, and the inability of people to contest when things are wrongly reported about them, and also the misuse of information, the lack of corroboration, and the government's misuse of this type of information has led to many, many instances of people being wrongly arrested, and that's happened on a widespread basis after 9/11 and before. That type of racial profiling has been rampant and used in everything from, you know, mortgage lending, you know, throughout the history of the United States. That this has been a problem, a way of categorizing people that is really problematic. And I just can foresee that this is going to be used in the way that you're indicating, putting together these databases and targeting people for the wrong reasons.
Barbara Olshansky of the Center for Constitutional Rights and Barry Steinhardt of the American Civil Liberties Union. I want to thank you both for being with us. In the last minute of this broadcast, we want to go down to our colleagues in Tampa, Florida, where a major hurricane is approaching. Hurricane Charley, expected 120 mile per hour winds, could devastate low-lying areas in Tampa and St. Petersburg. WMNF is there. Speak Up Tampa Bay is there. Public Access TV. We were just there on our Exception to the Rulers tour, met with 2,400 listeners and viewers. Rob Lauer, one of the leaders of WMNF, is there. Welcome, Rob.
Hi, Amy.
What's the weather like right now, and how are you preparing?
Well, Amy, you remember that Bob Dylan song where he says like the calm before the storm or the calm before the hurricane? Well, it's sort of like that right now. Believe it or not, it's a beautiful day here in Tampa, but we know that 8 or 10 hours from now we're going to be hit by one of the largest hurricanes ever to hit this area. This is a pretty densely populated area, and about 2 million people have been ordered to evacuate from the west coast of Florida. We're all, you know, preparing for the worst and hoping for the best.
Is WMNF evacuating? Also, CENTCOM is there, MacDill Air Base is there.
Well, luckily, MNF is in an area that's above the floodplain, but within the floodplain, about 2 million people have been ordered out. MNF, I think, is going to be safe. MacDill has been virtually shut down, and of course, it's where the war in Iraq is being managed, MacDill Air Force Base. But they've only got a skeleton crew there.
Rob Lauer, thanks for being with us. And that does it for, we won't say our underground weathermen, hopefully not underwater weathermen, but thanks for the weather report. That's it for the show. Democracy Now! Produced by the indomitable Mike Burke, Sharif Abdel-Qaddous, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill. Thanks to Dennis Moynihan, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer, Uri Galed, our director, our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.